Everyone, don't forget to go to rerunnersafety.com to get yourself some cool ass merch. Get yourself sweatshirts, t-shirts, mugs, tote bags, and you can support us a little bit more. And the best of it is you wouldn't even know you're supporting a health and safety channel because it just looks cool, man. Don't forget, rerunnersafety.com. Get yourself some merch, peeps. Safe. What's up, people? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety, or should I say, I'm back at Rebranding Safety. I understand I've been gone for a long time, and I can only apologise. Had a few people message me, say, hey, you're still doing a podcast, which kind of boosted my ego, which was nice, very nice to kind of get those messages. Nice to see that people cared as well. So thank you very much for those who messaged me. I'd like to read out all their names, but there was just too many. There was a joke. There was like a handful of them, but it was still really nice. So we are back. Let me briefly explain what's been going on. So if any of you follow me on LinkedIn, you'll understand that I was doing my NCRQ diploma, long overdue diploma, and for everyone that gave me the one piece of advice that was, you will need all 6 weeks to do this final assignment, it was probably the best advice I could have ever received because it genuinely did take me forever. That whole 6 weeks was kind of, yeah, just jam-packed of the diploma. I haven't done anything else. But then, I'll be brutally upfront with you, probably kind of had an early midlife crisis, maybe a burnout. I don't really know what happened. I just hit some like proper low, just didn't want to do anything. Really struggled to motivate myself to do the diploma. So I feel like I'm coming out of that now. So that's nice. Talking to a lot of people has been very helpful. We've also just been mad busy for two reasons. Three reasons. The diploma, which I've already mentioned. Secondly, we had the HSC Congress, so keep your eye out on our YouTube channel if you haven't already hit subscribe. And on this podcast, because on this podcast we'll be having a recorded keynote from Eric Honagle. I think that's how you say it. Sorry if I've offended you, Eric. About safety too, so it was really good. So we've recorded his keynote. You'll be able to get the video version of that and the podcast version of that. So make sure you keep subscribed if you haven't dissubscribed or unsubscribed since we've been gone for so long. I would understand if you have. So Eric's gonna be on there. We'll also be doing a vlog of day one and a vlog of day two, which will be like little bits and bobs of what we did and what it looked like. Also some like little reviews of some keynotes and stuff that we did. You'll get a real good feel of what it's like to be a delegate at that. So keep tuned. There's gonna be some great videos. We are currently editing those now. So much content to kind of get into one video, ideally under 10 minutes, is actually really difficult. But I really enjoyed the event. So keep tuned for those videos. Where are we? That was number two. Number three is Rebranding Safety is going to have a mini Rebranding Safety. No, not a new podcast. Myself and my wife are having our first child. That's it really. So I think that kind of probably majorly constituted to my early mid-life crisis. So surrounded by like nappies and things. Sorry for those that are just listening on the podcast, but literally, studio's been overgrown. That's a lie. I've literally just kind of started clearing out the back room because we're going to move into the back room, me and you, podcast people, studio. We're going to move into a different room. And this room is going to become the baby room, which was always the plan. You don't really care about that stuff. So we have jiggled around the schedule. So primarily the plan was for you to be listening to Robert Jukes next in this week's podcast, and then listening to Megan Rachel, and then who were talking all about like culture types, which is a really interesting conversation. And then listening to, we've got a few pre-recorded ones ready to go. But I had already recorded the intros and outros to Robert, and I wanted to do a little special intro to just explain why we've disappeared, apologise because we've disappeared, say, hey, I'm having a baby, and that's it really. So today in this episode, we're going to be talking to Gareth Evans, who works at Yonder Group, who is their head of safety, director of safety, blah, 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 the top dog of safety within that business. And it's quite an interesting conversation, actually, because what Yonder are doing is trying to just be, like, they're very innovative, kind of like a startup, Gareth describes them as, but like a big startup. And they basically build, like, and I've probably got this wrong, but like huge data centers, and they want to do it quicker than everyone else and better than everyone else. Now, when anyone says to safety people want to do it quicker than anyone else, that starts ringing alarm bells, doesn't it? So that's a really interesting conversation. The relationship between him and the board at Yonder and the freedom he's given and just the kind of way he's managing it is kind of refreshing to listen to as well. Overall, just a very good conversation. And actually, you know what, I probably should have recorded this after the weekend's rugby, because obviously England are going to beat Wales in the Six Nations, and I think Gareth might be a little bit upset about that, and I could have had it in this interview. But, oh well, too late. We actually recorded it months ago. So, without further ado, Gareth wants to change the world with health and safety, and in this podcast, we're going to talk about how he's going to do that. It's Rebranded Safety with Gareth Evans.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
Weird and oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranded Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent and your host, James McPherson. Right, Gareth, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, James.
Why don't you give us a little introduction into yourself and Yonder Group as well, and just kind of what you do, who you are, what they do, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, cool. So, my name's Gareth Evans. I am the group health, safety, quality and environment director for Yonder Group. Yonder, what we do, so we are a completely outsourced end-to-end solutions company. Basically in the data center world, we look at capacity, so hyperscale data centers, and we look at the technical real estate, and we deliver that generally faster than anybody else in the market. We take away our clients' constraints, we're completely self-funded. We take care of the designer element. We deliver the construction through our partners. And then we operate the hyperscale data center in its entirety. So across Europe, we're in Netherlands and some other places coming up pretty soon. And yeah, so the clients can choose the fully outsourced solutions for the full life cycle and pick apart the different bits that suit them. So it's complete turnkey.
Okay. What are we talking? Big, are we talking small data, are we talking all of the above?
If people aren't aware of the sort of data center world, we generally talk in hyperscale. So if I think of our project in the Netherlands at the moment, it's currently sitting over 500 meters long. It's a big site to walk around, so you definitely get your steps in. In terms of power, 60 megawatts of energy to power it, and if you put that into sort of real world, that's probably twice the capacity of power in Peterborough.
Wow.
In terms of what it takes to keep the lights on and such, and keep store this information for these for our customers, it's no mean feat at all. Yeah.
My experience of construction of data centers was a very small in comparison to what you're talking about, data center in a hospital for the whole trust. Within the NHS, and it was probably, I'm terrible with numbers, so I wouldn't even want to guess, but it was like a small bedroom size. But it took us, it was a huge project. This contractor, to be fair, was really good. It was slick, obviously held all like the data security stuff, so that was all, and obviously with it being like with the fire suppression systems and stuff. So obviously access was kind of strict and stuff, but the construction project itself was lengthy, and the amount of intrusive works it had on the impact on the wider building as well was shocking. You know, I'm sitting here as a layman when it comes to that kind of stuff, just thinking, just putting a big computer in a room, what's the problem? Yeah. And the work, so for you, must be absolutely huge. I mean, these construction products, how long are we talking, like lengthwise or size-wise?
So 60 megawatt data center from first pile in the ground to being in operational state, it's taken 13 months.
Okay. And you say you're quicker than most, so what's that? How much quicker are you?
You think, generally to market, the deal we had with Yonder, so we're a completely brand new company, only really been going since 2019. And most other data center or capacity clients, they would maybe take maybe 2 to 3 years for something similar.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you kind of balance that? That's one of Yonder's biggest selling points, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that part, you know, the construction part is just an element of that. But yeah, instead of going down that traditional GC, general contractor or principal contractor in the UK and subcontractor route, we're operating as kind of under a lean construction module. So that's IPD, Integrated Project Delivery. And so rather than having a quite heavy management team on site or management company as a principal contractor, we look at the best partners or the best people for the job. So like in terms of the project, the M&E guys would lead on the part of the M&E. The steel guys would lead on putting the steel up in the frame. Again, with the civils, they take care of that and logistics. So we take the best. We basically rely on the expertise of our subcontractors to pull that in, and obviously the construction element of that then is being delivered currently by ISG, who are a sister company to Yonder. We're owned by the Cathexis Group, so it's very much so keeping it all in that sort of family for now.
Mm. With that kind of one of the bigger selling points of the obviously. It's kind of like a life cycle thing. I understand that. So, but from it must be a big selling point from the construction point to say, hey, we're you know nearly a few you know quite a bit quicker than everyone else. Get my words out of my mouth. Yeah. How does that conflict with like safety and kind of how do you manage that relationship? Because I'm not saying it can't be done. What I'm trying to get to is a lot of people would see that as a negative. So, you know, where you're like, right, we've got to build this quick and fast. And it's like first thing that a lot of maybe traditional or even it doesn't have to be traditional, just normal safety professionals would first be thinking, right, okay, speed. So that's pressure. So we're going to start cutting corners, you know. So you must have to work quite hard on your overall kind of respect and culture around risk management as a whole. To be able to enable the business to do that in a reasonably safe manner, in a practical manner, I suppose. As well.
Absolutely. I think it's more than anything, get rid of the bureaucracy. There's so much that you need to do this and you need to do that. And I think one of our taglines is that we deliver end-to-end solutions elegantly. When I think of that, that's not necessarily like this is going to be the prettiest building in the world, because let's face it, it's a big grey warehouse in the middle of the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. It's for me elegantly is that when things maybe aren't going right, you're not necessarily pulling up the contracts and going through that line by line. It's let's get together, let's work on this. So I think the advantage of IPD as well is, whereas general construction, they're making quite small margins. When you haven't got that big layer in it, people are making a lot more money, the people involved in this. So when you keep your eye on the prize of we do this right and we work together, rather than having different levels of people get this, people get that, it's set up from the front. And we, you know, people generally do a lot better out of this. And I think through other case studies of IPD, so it's generally originated out in California, and looking at other companies have gone down this route, generally being a lot more successful. That's all right, no problem at all.
Sorry, mate.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah,
unfortunately, so I can't put a dog on silent.
Yeah, that's it, no worries. Yeah, so I think at that point, I think when we got the respect there, we got the mutual trust and empowerment in the teams to deliver it. Yeah, we take that bureaucracy out of it. And generally, like I said, it's not all sunshine and roses. There are difficult times in it. But if we generally keep our eye on the prize, it tends to be, it tends to work, differently to that general contractor, subcontractor route. But it's hopefully it's the model we're going to go down, and it's proved successful so far.
I find it fascinating, one of the things you kind of said there about you're not so much just kind of looking for the cheapest contractor. It's more just like just looking for quality in your subbies and stuff like that. And more elegant. I like that tagline, and I like elegant as a word. It's nice. Yep. But it's interesting, and I find it fascinating that, you know, it's kind of common practice, isn't it? You go get a job, you get three quotes, you pick the cheapest one. It's like, and that just goes all the way up to corporate side. And then what you do is you kick up fuss when you realize, oh, you know, whatever you're building, it could be a house. Let's take a house, for example. You're building a house, you think, oh, my house is shit. Well, yeah, because you picked the cheapest contractor, and now you're wondering why. I just find it fascinating that sometimes, I'm not saying everybody's like this, but in my experience, everyone just seems to be so short-sighted. It's like, or we're not happy with the product we're getting. Well, that's because you paid nothing. You paid next to nothing. And a good example of that, actually, I mean, you could go back to the earlier episodes of this podcast. And the first episode we started was my phone and hands-free kit. So it literally cost me nothing, but the quality was horrendous. And then the next one was a £10 microphone or something like that off of eBay, direct from China. It was horrendous. And then when late last year, I kind of listened through it. And you can literally hear the pounds being spent by the quality improving, and it's the same thing. And there's so much to talk about that. I want to touch on the trust piece that you said about. I think that's really important as well. But let's just kind of explore that kind of short-sightedness thing then, about like what do you think? And this is not, you're not going to be able to give me the right answer or the wrong answer. There probably isn't a right or wrong answer. Yeah. But what is it that makes us so short-sighted that we're just like, just get the cheapest contractor? Is that, why can't we just say, well, let's just find the right contractor? Doesn't necessarily have to be the most expensive. Doesn't necessarily have to be the most qualified, but the one that fits your values, your aim, etc.
So I think, the experience from where I'm currently, it's not necessarily the case of finding the cheapest people to do something, because I think our end goal is where we're not just looking at construction. We're looking at, you know, we got to operate this thing for the next 15 years at least. Yeah. So if we build something really cheaply, it's going to start breaking. Then we're going to get into places like SLA breaches, stuff like that, which is a whole world of it, which is going to cost us down the line. So it's for me, what you think of getting that product, and in terms of the guys who work on the construction side of it, that who work with us, it's I think it's getting rid of any sort of self-arrogance to believe you know the best. And for me, and like that IPD thing if I think of, you know, our group as such, where we are, we got sort of technical authorities, so where I might take that title, even though titles don't really mean much to me, of group director on it. When I think of the electricity running through the data center, I'm not necessarily an expert in electricity, but I know my electrical engineer, who's in the Netherlands, for example, who's, you know, I class him as a complete genius in that sort of side of it, and, you know, a bit of a mad scientist, built his own electric car. So when I want to know about electricity, I'll speak to him. We'll make sure he's empowered to make that call on it, because he's lived that. He's done that for the last 20, 30 years. Whereas what we do is, in terms of safety professionals, it's not necessarily know all everything, but I believe the role that I got essentially is try to pull out the best of people, give them the tools they need to succeed, and get out. And more than anything is get from under their feet. If they tell me that's the right thing to do, and they're an expert in that, you know, there's, you know, there's positive challenge, but there's, you know, there's no way, what right do I have to go against somebody, like I said, who spent maybe, you know, they got a PhD in electrical engineering. It's a completely different thing compared to the training I have. So yeah.
I like that. Do you know what? That's quite similar. I'm just at the tail end of finishing off my diploma. Thank God. Been a long time coming. But towards the end of it, so I did the NCRQ one. So basically, it's towards the end of it, you look into the more high, more specific, but most of the higher risk kind of stuff. So you start looking at electricity, low voltage, high voltage. You start looking at fire. You start looking at confined space, etc. Explosions, all the lot. And I'm going through it, and I'm thinking like, I get what they're trying to do, and it's kind of like the industry is set like this. But as I'm going through it, I'm just like, it just feels wrong that I'm learning about electricity, to stick with your example, from one chapter in a book. Mm-hmm. I understand it's just given us a general knowledge to be able to maybe not challenge, but ask challenging questions to a PhD electrical engineers, and just to be able to say, okay, have we thought about this? And just be that person that maybe I always class a safety professional as a positive devil's advocate. It's kind of like our role. It's just to stand there and just ask questions and be like, in a positive manner, just saying, have we thought about this? What about this? What about this? And with the aim of getting the job done, obviously. And then that engineer goes, do you know what? I haven't thought about that. Great, that's what I'm here for. So I understand that we need a general knowledge of stuff, but it's kind of like, do our skills not need to focus more on like the kind of personality management, people management, understanding people, maybe a bit of psychology, sociology, things like that, instead of actually nailing down on the technical aspects of these risks? Because we employ electrical engineers, we'll employ an explosive specialist, if we've got an explosive atmosphere or something like that. And I feel like, do we need a bit of a shake up in the industry? And it's just interesting that you kind of touched on it as I was thinking of it the other day. And I was thinking, it just doesn't feel right. I'm not going to finish this book. I'm going to get a certificate, and people are going to think I'm competent, even though, you know, I've got loads of experience, but I need a piece of paper to tell everybody I'm competent, but I'm not going to get on that soapbox. For them to say like, oh yeah, we can employ James now as a safety specialist. It's like, no, I'm just a devil's advocate. That's all I am. That's all I'm here for. Maybe a culture specialist, but I don't know. It's difficult, because I think there's a fair argument that some people maybe from oil and gas that are like, I need to be a technical expert in oil and gas. And I'm like, well, do you? Because there's engineers on site. I'm just playing devil's advocate. It'd be interesting to see what you think.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it's when I kind of try to sell myself in an interview. I think that when I was applying for this job, I was like, well, you know, by nature as a safety professional, I don't like using that word professional, but we're kind of curious problem solvers. It's rather than anything, it's asking the right questions. And just to have a flavour of something and say, and like I said, it's that that thing of rather, you know, positive challenge, bringing people in, bringing them together, creating that environment. And you know, people like Amy Edmondson, when she talks about you know, the sort of teaming and psychological safety of getting the right people in the room, creating a platform where people feel empowered to talk up, and they feel like they can talk without repent. So it's for me, and I think of what we do in Yonder. So as company size, we're around 180, 190 people, and we're growing rapidly. It's to create that right culture. And I think the biggest risk I got for my guys in terms of physical risk is in terms of direct employees, is mentally creating that safe environment, making sure that they got, that they feel empowered, that they feel psychologically safe in their workplace. So there's and kind of when it went through the sort of business planning for Yonder of how we set the company up last year, it was I look at like authors like Dan Coyle, who wrote the Culture Code, and what's the other one, Culture Code, and tip of my tongue. And they look at sort of high performing teams, and they all share sort of three common traits, and it's that thing of a safe environment that could be, you know, physically and mentally safe. It's a common goal, so that common thematic goal, which you are pushing for the same thing, and shared vulnerability. And for me, that vulnerability is saying that, all right, I'll put my hands up when I make a mistake, but put your hands up when saying, hey, I don't know the answers to this, but I just want to ask the question, and I'm not sure, so let's find the answer out together. And pull people in the right place. And I say, if you get that 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 point where we get rid of hierarchies, it should be people positively challenging in every direction. And that's not necessarily, it shouldn't necessarily be seen as criticism, it should be seen as a positive thing.
There is just so many examples of why this kind of transition into moving away from the blame game and stuff. And I think this will transition into the little connection of the conversation we have about similarities between what you're trying to do in the future at Yonder or now at Yonder and what the kind of aviation industry do. But I think aviation is a prime example. They're still not perfect, don't get me wrong. There's films that will show you that. I mean, anyone who's not an advocate, not a geek like me and wants to just watch a film, they can go watch Sully. And that's a prime example of you know, how the aviation industry can still get it wrong, but eventually towards the end of the film, get it right. I know there's an example, is it Hotel Oscar, the flight that came down in the UK, and they kind of blamed the pilot as well. I might have got that wrong. I can't remember the number of the flight. It was like a really long number, but they nicknamed it Hotel Oscar, I think, because Hotel.
Down on the roof.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they were like, I don't know, like six inches from the roof or something like that in London. That's it. And they blame that on the pilot. And it's like, without kind of stepping back and with that blame mentality, you're missing so much. And actually, that is a horrific story. It's explained really well in Black Box Thinking.
Yeah.
In a book by Matthew Syed, explains it beautifully well, and he adds his own little bit to it as well. So if anybody kind of thinking, I want to learn about that, maybe that might be the better way to do it, I think. But anyway, to get to the point, it's like it's this new thing that we're discovering. Like, oh, let's stop blaming people and punishing people. We might actually create a better environment. But then I think it's not a new thing. And this is funny you mentioned this as well, because one of my guilty pleasures is Sharp. I don't know if you remember the really old series Sharp with Sean Bean in.
Yes. Yeah,
when he's like 20 years old or something like that. Unbelievably young, right? It's unbelievably old. It's terrible, but I just love it. I love it so much, right? And there is so much about leadership in that show that is unbelievable that we've not picked it up, that it's took us from to now to just start thinking about this. And a prime example is back then they used to flog soldiers, right? So you get whipped, right, if you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
And then when they start winning the war, it's all like the Napoleonic War. When they start winning the war, these soldiers start going pillaging, raping, looting, and they just become, you know, there's all hierarchy's gone out the window. They don't care. Because why? Because they've been treated like shit. They've been blamed and punished for everything that the tiny, I mean, not keeping your chin up in whilst marching, you get flogged for it. So it doesn't create an environment where they want to be. And they're meant to put their life on a line. Whereas if you look at Sharp and how he manages his little gang of, they're called Chosen Men and all this, right? And they have respect. They have respect for the leader, but they have respect for their leader, Sharp, because he has respect for them. He protects them and they protect him. And it creates this little group. They end up becoming the specialists of this war, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, I'm watching this and I'm thinking, hang on a minute. This book was written like early 1900s, I think. Well, not early 1900s, but you know, it was like 90s, 80s, I don't know. And I'm thinking, so actually we knew this. We knew that leadership and respect and that get us so much further than punishment and hierarchy. Why are we still got businesses now that kind of go to this point? We're having incidents and accidents and we're looking for that person. Now, whose fault was that? Must be operator error. I'm waffling on and I will get to the question. I realize that, you know, you're the guest on here, it should be you talking more than me.
It's good conversation.
But like this point you've kind of touched on has been in my head for like a while now, and we just had on the news recently, haven't we, that plane that got shot down over Iran. Or somewhere near that, right? And what have Iran said? It's operator error. It was on the bloody news now, and 2019, 2020, I can't remember when they put it on the news, operator error. I'm like, nah, mate, we are so beyond operator error. Okay, so, me going on and on and on for the last 20 minutes, probably, I'm trying to come around to a point that aviation society, the aviation industry, have kind of caught on to this a while ago. So for those people that don't know, they kind of, no matter where you are, and as much as I've read anyway, I've never worked in aviation, so anyone that has can correct me if I'm wrong, but they share incidents from a perception of how can we stop this again, and looking at the overarching picture, not trying to allocate blame. Which brings us quite nicely onto one of the things that you're trying to do at Yonder is quite similar to that, would you say?
Yeah, exactly that, to a point. So, you know, I think in terms of stealing with pride, probably a similar process for me, if we look at the people who were involved or the companies involved in the construction side and the maintenance side and whatever, they come from the sort of data center world is quite a small industry and quite incestuous. So they come from more or less the same stock. So it's, if there's a issue or something doesn't go quite right on our project, chances are that in 6 months' time when they go to the next project, then they could potentially have the same issue. Mm-hmm. So talking with guys in our company was like, well, why don't we put our details public? Why don't we put it out there and make that free, open information? And they say, I have that shared vulnerability of, you know, things probably don't go right all the time, but if it improves the overall industry, it's not just helping us for future builds, but it's helping our competition. It's bringing people along. I mean, for the majority of it, we got nothing to hide. I'll say for the majority, for all of it, there's, you know, things go right and things go wrong. And I believe when you get, you know, people like Sydney Decker talk about it a lot with the sort of just culture, and that sort of safety anarchy part of it. It's taking those lessons and making sure they're implemented. There's been so many instances I've seen with other organisations where, I'm going to name them, but something goes wrong and they go, right, in a construction environment, I'll do a toolbox talk and it won't happen again. I think of positively challenging that, I'm like, do you really believe a toolbox talk will prevent that reportable accident happen again? Do you want to look at your process? Do you want to look at how you get the information across? Do you want to look at your, you know, why is somebody in office writing your risk assessment method statements? Why is a safety manager doing that? And why is not the guy who's doing the work doing that? Because if I think of how we've set, like even for Yonder in our management systems, for example, you know, we got sort of three sort of main operating areas in terms of our development team who are development design. We got our operations team, and then we got the sort of technical specialists to do the IT installs, stuff like that. So they're quite vastly different businesses. So if we put in this sort of really rigid structure and say, for example, that the guys who are essentially do the FM role of operating a data center, if we say, right, you've got to follow construction processes through that, it's by nature. If people don't like doing something, they're going to do what they want to do. So why don't we give people some guidance, you know, some clear guidance and rules, and then allow flexibility for people to build how they want to build? So, and if I think, you know, I've got a bit off track on that, but if I think of sharing information, if it improves the industry and makes people safer, I mean, no matter which way you look at it, is you know, our number one role as such is make sure people get home or assisting people getting home at night. It doesn't matter who you work for. It doesn't matter what color badge you're wearing or what color t-shirt you're wearing. It's you take a human element to that and make it really personal. I don't think anybody wants to see people get hurt. And if there's something that I can do in my role and something we can do in an organization which prevents somebody 6 months down the line getting hurt or people having access to information to improve that, let's shout about it. Let's prevent people in the future getting hurt through mistakes that might have happened on our projects. And then what I'd like in return is that, you know, potentially if companies feel brave enough, join us in that. Let's put your accident statistics, let's put your you know, your root cause analysis and your lessons learned on that, publish that. We're investing in a platform to put that online, which will sit, you know, and that's hopefully we want to create the point where this is a global lesson learned platform. You know, Yonder at the moment, we are just opened up before Christmas in Asia. We opened up this year in Americas. So it's a global business, and this is something that's going to definitely span the globe. And it's just inviting people to come on that journey with us. It's not about who you work for or who you make money for or how much money you make. It's about taking that human element into it and saying, I want to make sure that people are safer. And it's by doing that, hopefully, that's going to contribute to that in some way.
Mm, I like that. To get to this kind of point, you must have... You keep the way you kind of talk about it and what you're under doing, it reminds me of, and you kind of touched on it earlier when you're talking about Amy Edmondson as well, but reminds me when we had Dr. Dara Blumenthal on the podcast, and she's like a doctor of sociology, and she was talking about psychological safety and all that, and something that she said, I'm quite a big fan of one-liners because my brain can't handle much more, but it's like what she said is like, you need to create an environment where everybody is comfortable with being briefly uncomfortable. And then somebody else said something on a different podcast I was listening to, was like, and they were talking about managing people, and they were saying, we need to be able to be in a position where we all know the end goal. So if you all know the end goal, yonder is delivering elegant data centers with and sending people home and improving safety as a wider industry if we can. That's our goal. It feels okay for people to challenge us, and it feels okay for maybe the road to get a little bit bumpy, and it feels uncomfortable, but we're comfortable with that because we know our goals. And that must have been an interesting transition to see, and started probably within yonder with the subcontractors building that trust and getting quality contractors and just saying, hey, look, this is what we're doing, and if you don't fit this line, that's fine. You just go elsewhere and we're going to crack on. I love that.
I think, you know, I'm really, really fortunate that I think of the sort of leadership team, the C-level leadership, CEO, COO, CDO and CFO who kind of run yonder. They're very progressive, very forward thinking, and every meeting or time I spend with them, you know, on a weekly basis, it always challenges me to push more. Don't think of traditionally. So our sort of tagline in yonder is tomorrow without constraints. So don't constrain yourself to what traditional the norm is. Don't settle for. And I think when people say, you know, I want to be the best in the world, I say, well, I don't just want to perform the best in the world, but I want to outperform myself. I really want to push it. But we, you know, how we do that in terms of performance management is making sure that there's, you know, we reward people when they do right, but at the same time, we learn from stuff when it's not quite there as well. But it's that, you know, just culture tag, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I like that. I like that tomorrow without constraints. So I think that's nice. That, like, you know, so many people think of kind of safety. I use that as a kind of collective term of health, safety, and kind of. I much prefer risk management, if I'm honest. But like, people see that as a constraint, don't they? Like that must have been. Was that not naturally? Were your kind of leaders, business leaders within yonder, were they naturally didn't think like that anyway, or was that a conversation you had to have with them? Or
they were really open, really, really open. I think in terms of a company, we're growing so fast, it's getting people, everyone mutually trusts each other. Let's rely on what we do and the ideas, and let them flow. And so it seems to be hitting the mark at the moment. It's giving people that autonomy and freedom to create that culture for people to thrive in. Yeah.
I love that. I love that kind of, personally, you know, I've had a very small handful, probably a couple of peas actually, not so much a handful of managers that kind of try and create a work environment like that and just say, hey, look, you know, I employed you, so I deem you competent to do what you want to do. I trust you. Go on, off you go. Just go and do what you need to do. And if there's any problems, give me a call. And, you know, personally, I thrive off of that. I absolutely thrive off of that. Now, don't get me wrong. I think maybe some personalities wouldn't thrive in that environment and maybe need that kind of, not so much micromanagement from a negative term, but, you know, they need that kind of, here's a to-do list. But I think for a business to be, well, not so much a business, for this industry and culture piece, and just culture is a great example, there needs to be trust. And I think from your point of view, when we spoke last time, you've got a huge team all over the world. And it's pretty much got to be impossible for you to manage, you know, people in, if I remember rightly, you've got people working in the Netherlands and everywhere within your team of safety professionals.
Yeah,
you couldn't do that without trust.
No, so I think in terms of safety teams at the moment, we got guys in far out in Finland, a few locations in the Netherlands, Belgium, UK, soon to be Asia, and then probably later this year in the States as well. It's like you said, when in terms of, you know, there's got to be levels of governance and there's got to be levels of structure, but to truly build a platform for people to operate in, they got to have the flexibility to put in what they believe is right for their part of the business or what they're working on. So I think when we were going around setting our management systems up last year, here was lots of research looking at different industries. Really fortunate, I went down to Switzerland, spent some time with the guys in JTI, Japanese tobacco industry, which is completely right field or left field from compared to what the data center industry was. And Jim Howard on there was really, really receptive and great guy to kind of show us what they do in terms of their model being a relatively small corporate function with a massive operational output. It was a similar sort of thing for us. And we looked at different models of what works in terms of management systems. And we decided that, you know, that thing of if we set completely rigid guidelines of how we're going to work, then people are just going to break rules. I think it was reading a book. Is it Tim Marsh when he talks about people who are breaking rules? And it's that thing of sitting in a room with people and saying how many people drive over the speed limit and then stick their hand up, and how many people have, you know, smoked or gone to work with a hangover when they probably shouldn't be driving. And you can more or less guarantee 99% of the room is going to stick their hand up. And then you say you set so rigid rules for people that naturally when they're not comfortable with them, they're going to break them. Mm-hmm. So if you trust people and they're there to do a job, less, you know, it's that safety anarchy point, which Sydney Decker talks about, is take away the rules and people will naturally want to do the right thing. But you give people guidelines and flexibility. You say, look, go forth, do it, and build that to what works for you. It's just what we're doing at my point from across the group level is setting those minimum standards and the guys are building systems to work for them.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people look at this and maybe listen to this or a lot of people misinterpret a lot of Sydney Decker's work and stuff like that and think that it's a culture of no blame. It's a culture of no accountability. That's what I've been challenged on before. No hierarchy, no structure, no accountability. It is anarchy. And I said, well, no, I don't think he advocates for no, like it's called a just culture for a reason. Like it means that it's just by the fact that it's justice in a way that if you are accountable, you knowingly did something wrong and there's just no way that the business, the systems, the context of the situation has contributed to that, you were just a dick, then you're going to be held accountable for that. And I think it's important that people know that when we, and it'd be interesting to see your point, but when we're talking about this and my wife calls my outlook on safety kind of like spiritual, which I think that's just a way of describing it. Like it's not spiritual in any way. It's just creating a place where people thrive to do what they need to do. A place where people are trusted to do what they're employed and deemed competent to do. It does not mean you're not held accountable for what you're doing. You will. If we've talked maybe from a quality point of view, if we're running a machine and at the end of that machine we want a ball, that ball must be certain circumference, and it comes out and it's not that certain circumference, we're going to ask the question why. It just turns out that the machine operator set the circumference wrong. Then we're going to ask, why did they set the circumference wrong? Oh, they were just pissed and they had a glass of wine before they came in or whatever. It's like, okay, accountability. Do you know what I mean? And you could probably go even further and ask, why are they drinking alcohol before they came in? And that's just a very loose example. But accountability does exist in these kind of trust-based, just culture scenarios. It just creates a better place to work, in my opinion.
I think personally for me, it's more so than any sort of financial gain is everyone feels like they want to work in a place where they feel valued, and create a value in some way and feel like you're making a difference. And, you know, more so than, you know, any sort of financial gain on that is to feel, you know, we spend so much time in work, but so much of our lives in a working environment. I mean, I genuinely come to work and have fun, I enjoy it.
Love that.
I enjoy interacting with people. There's, you know, there's not a day, I spent quite a long time in my early 20s in a job I disliked. And I believe I'd never put myself in that situation again. So it's, you know, getting that environment right and getting that culture where people said that they can speak up, they can positively challenge things, and not just across safety, but across the tasks that people do. I think when you apply it, but then when you apply that safety element to it, is that if people feel like they can talk up and talk about something, it's just really, it's a really powerful, powerful tool, you know, in terms of catching observations, you know, being a proactive, having a proactive element to that rather than something's happened, let's be reactive and let's figure out what went wrong. Let's nip it in the butt early. Let's create that environment where people feel, you know, I'm going to talk up and people are going to listen to me.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like when it's people that with that question, like, why are we not getting any near miss reports? Or why are people not, you know, reporting hazards and stuff? Or it's a classic thing, isn't it? If you're investigating an incident as a safety professional, maybe, and someone goes, why? Been on that for years, mate. And you're just like, why have you not told me? And then when you take a step back and you look at it, and it's like, the business is all about accountability. You know, you need to be accountability. And I just think, well, there is accountability, but actually what you may have created is, what you may have created is a culture of blame. And then you wonder why near misses are not being reported, because they don't want to report it, because the last guy that reported something got blamed for it and then sacked or something like that. It's got to be that trust piece. It's got to be.
I think it's probably once that when, I think like I said, when, you know, I talk about governance, is that when, all right, you create that environment for people to raise observations or raise near misses. But I think what's probably worse than that is somebody shouting about something and nobody listening. It's having the process but action behind it. Cause it's that thing of the boy who cried wolf. There's only so many times people are going to shout up and down, and if people don't listen or don't have the mechanism to act on something, then they're going to stop talking.
Yeah, that's the other thing, isn't it? It's that kind of, I remember delivering some training once for a business that I was working for at the time, and I'm quite an honest person. Anyone listening to podcasts probably worked that out. So I kind of, I found it's important, especially when I was delivering this training. So basically I was delivering this training through the nation, and I had a certain patch within that nation, obviously. And I found it important that when I was going around to be honest and not kind of sell bullshit. So walk around being like, you know, we as a business are going to invest in this, I'm going to do this. And I would say, hey, these are some ideas that are going on, but if I'm honest, I'm a bit pessimistic as whether this stuff's actually going to land, because the board are not buying into it. And that was how I felt. So that was what I told people. And the lady came up to me and she said, I really enjoyed your training, blah, 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 blah. She was blowing smoke up my ass, so I'd have listened to her all day. And she said, but I don't know how you haven't been fired yet. And I was a bit taken aback, and I was like, excuse me? And she said, like, the way you talk about the board and you're so honest, and no one stood up in front of us and said, you know, I actually don't think the board is going to buy into this. I actually don't think the board are going to spend money on this. I don't know how they haven't fired you. You want to be careful. I said, I don't want to be careful. If they fire me, they fire me. My wife would be really upset, but that aside, we'll deal with it. But and she asked me why then. And I said, I need you to trust me. If I tell you in this room that we're going to do this, we're going to spend this, we're going to do that, and then we don't do it, you don't trust me. And it's a good example of that, like that kind of, I've reported near misses, but you've done nothing about it, so I'm not going to report them anymore. And she was a bit like, I'm confused. And I said, right, let's put it this way. One day I'm going to come along to your site and there's going to be something seriously wrong, or you're going to really need my help, or worst case scenario, I'm going to turn up and have to tell you to stop straight away. I cannot do that unless you trust me. I need you to have a strong, trusting relationship with me or the rest of my team to be able to do that. And it's that classic thing of like near miss reporting. We don't do it maybe because people get blamed, whatever, but also we don't do it because you're not listening to us. And then that breaks the trust in a way, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sounds interesting. And it just seems like that seems like the golden thread through this whole thing. And I feel like Yonder really couldn't do what they're doing right now if you didn't have that golden thread of trust that everybody is working towards the same goal of delivering elegant solutions. Is that right?
Yeah. Elegant. I say solutions, like just data centers. Yeah. We'll be delivering centers.
So I remember you telling me, this is something that's stuck in my head that I think about, and I might be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, that when you're in your interview, you said you wanted to change the world. Is that right?
Yep.
And is do you feel like you're on track with that? Feel like what you're doing now is going to change the world?
Hopefully. I'm not sure what that looks like, but hopefully the thing about sharing information, being transparent, not having anything to hide, if I can use this company and this thing as a platform to positively influence people, I think that's a better achievement than anything else I can do in my life. It's starting to shape, and I'm hoping. I don't think that thing about sharing information and sharing, you know, sharing accident information or sharing safety information I don't think it'll come without criticism. I'm not being naive with that, and I don't think it's going to be as easy as it sounds on paper, and I think it'll be a lot of challenge, but let's see what happens.
I like that. Have you received any kind of challenges so far, like other businesses that you're trying to get in, or is it early days?
Not really. So I think it's more at the moment we're working with a quite well-respected partner in developing a platform where this kind of sits, and it'll be something that when it comes out, it'll be between us and them jointly, and you know it'll provide value for them, for us, for everyone. So it's very much in its infancy. This is something talking when I was having a chat with my sort of CEO about this, about very much that Matthew Saeed book, The Black Box Thinking. And we were like, well, if we're doing this and we're creating a better place for the industry, why aren't we doing what the aviation industry does? Mm. I was like, I don't know, why aren't we doing that? And he's like, well, will you tell me? This is what we should be doing. I was like, yeah, absolutely. And from that conversation, it just turned into, right, let's talk to some people. Let's get some things in place. Let's start building on it, and let's start seeing what that looks like.
I love that. Do you think that I think when you say about like the challenges piece, I think that's it's an interesting thing. I think you will kind of struggle to get buy-in in the beginning. I think that's inevitable, isn't it? Not from within Yonder, maybe, because it sounds like the board's already brought into everything. But from outside, you're going to come across that kind of archaic kind of attitude of that, seeing that as a threat maybe to the brand, to say, hang on a minute, we just hurt somebody and you want us to tell everybody about it? Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think that's interesting.
It's, you know, at that point, you can throw that back on people and say, well, I got nothing to hide, why are you hiding? That's
I think as well, it's that kind of piece of looking at it, the potential positive impact on the brand. So I've used this example a lot of times, but obviously within housing and fire safety and construction as well, you know, we're in a muddy patch with after Grenfell and all that. So everybody's, you know, what is it, like 3 years on now, everybody seems to have shut down. The whole industry seems to have shut down. They're waiting to be told what to do by the government. Now, don't get me wrong, there are some early adopters of the Hackett report that seem to have taken lead, but that's about it, if I'm honest. Everybody's sitting around waiting to be told what to do. And don't get me wrong, there's some things I do think we should sit and hold off and just kind of wait and just see how the land lies. However, what I don't understand is how not many businesses, especially housing associations, are not seeing this as an opportunity to have a positive impact on their brand. So what if McPherson Housing, for example, mid to late last year, had that student block that was on fire. And I don't think anybody passed away, thank God. But that was on fire. Now, what if McPherson Housing, for example, specialised in student accommodation? And I see that fire, and everyone's talking about it within the industry and on the news, etc. And I'm thinking, well, this is an opportunity for me. I'm going to proactively attack this, and I'm going to shout from the hilltops and the rooftops and every kind of tops to say, this is what McPherson Housing have done. We're proactively fire risk assessing our building. We're innovative in the way we do that. We're getting our housing managers involved. We're sharing our fire risk assessors with our customers, like Hackett says. We're openly sharing our incidents and fires to kind of help people. We've replaced all the cladding. We've done whatever, like all this cladding thing. And I think, like, I pitched to a business after this kind of thing. They were like, oh, what are we going to do about the cladding? I said, forget about the cladding. Leave it for now, right? Legislation's not retrospective, so technically we don't have to replace that. Why don't we replace everyone's white goods within the buildings that have got cladding on the property? And everyone just kind of looked at me. And I've said this time and time again in the podcast. People are probably thinking, here we go again. But why don't we do that? And everyone kind of looked at me and I was like, well, if I was going to do a risk assessment, I would attack the ignition source. And the ignition source of that fire was white goods. Not, why don't we replace that? Well, because it's not our responsibility within the flat. No, I get that. But imagine, just imagine if your name, McPherson Housing, for example, was on BBC News. McPherson Housing replaces all customers' white goods and gives them a free check or whatever within their property, completely free. Everyone's thinking, whoa, I just got a new tumble dryer, new washing machine, new dishwasher, new fridge, all brand new for free. How'd you get that? My housing association, they don't want it set on fire. They've said, yes, we've got the cladding, we're going to fix it, but it's going to take us time. It's going to take us money. It's going to cost us money, and we want to do it right, and we want to do it once. To do that, we want to control the ignition source. Imagine the potential impact, the potential positive impact on your brand of doing something like that. I thought I'd sold that, and I thought, I'm going to walk out of here like Conor McGregor. The response I got back was, we'd be taking on extra liability. We're not going to do it. And I'm just like, oh, for fuck's sake. It's just so frustrating. So I think you will come across those kind of industries that are a bit archaic and a bit old fashioned in their mentality. And I think you're going to have challenges, but I think don't let that kind of get you down and just keep chipping away. Cause eventually people will start to see that actually, if we look after people, they'll look after us, and that's only good for our brand. You know, people are going to say, who builds data centers? Oh, that Yonder Group, they were on the news the other day for doing this crazy innovative thing with safety. Oh, okay, let's have a look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's one of the sort of, you say about being innovative is in terms of a company, what we're doing, we're heavily investing in R&D. And when we consider like the research and development and in terms of industry, there's only one industry lower in than construction in R&D anywhere in the world, globally. So you think there's one step below construction in terms of research and development is hunting and fishing.
Hmm.
It's and you think about a fishing rod, that's not really changed much over the last last 100 years, 200 years or whatever. And the same in terms of hunting. So if when we were looking at the, you know, we're self-funded, we've got, you know, good money sat behind us, it's less invest in our research, less think of, you know, we're not talking about, you know, short term what's going to change in the next year or two. Let's look at the future. So it's for us, it's not just looking at it as a construction project. Like I said, we're invested for the next 10, 20 years, 30 years. So it's what if we can change something now or put the wheels in motion for something now, then yeah, let's put that in place. Let's invest in that, and let's bring positive change.
I like that. And I think as well, it's worth saying that, like, well, I don't think we're sitting here advocating that people go and spend thousands of pounds on kind of, you know, what do you call it? Future-proofing all their property, their machines, their businesses. You don't have to do that with everything, but have that conversation at least, and just say, is there an opportunity to future-proof here? Is there an opportunity to be better here? Like, is there an opportunity? I think that's worth. We're not sitting here saying you have to spend loads of money and be innovative. We're just saying you just have to ask some questions and just say, are there better ways to do this? Is anybody else in our industry doing it better than us? Can we engage with them? And I just think asking questions in a positive manner with a positive aim, we're just going to be in a much better situation, aren't we?
Be that curious problem solver.
Yeah, exactly. I like that. I'm going to steal that. Curious problem solving. And it was interesting that you say that you use that word curious, but we had, was it Jonathan Dempsey was on the podcast a long time ago. Again, quite similar to yourself, just a health and safety professional that I kind of connected with on social media that I was quite interested about what they do. And I got him on and he actually came round here to the studio. He was only local, so he just drove around here. We had a good chat, coffee. And coming on a podcast, he used the word curious. He just said, that's all we are. That's all we need to be, is curious as safety professionals. But not even just safety professionals, as kind of business leaders, you know, curiosity is that key that I think that opens the door to the future in a way, isn't it? But it's also that kind of social piece you were saying about earlier, and it kind of brings us back quite nicely back to what you're doing around your kind of incidents and stuff like that, and being a bit more social in a way with your competitors potentially, but with anyone within the industry, you're being social. And it's interesting if you look back, and I'm stealing Matthew Syed's stuff again from his other book in Rebel Ideas, but you know, he talks about it with like Silicon Valley, and what made Silicon Valley so popular and so successful was they were social. All these people just went down the pub. You know, after work, they all just went down the pub and spoke to each other. It didn't matter whether one's from whatever the business was, the birth business of Apple or Microsoft or whatever the bloody hell it was. They're down the pub, they're having a pint, they're sharing ideas, and then each person adds their own idea to that idea that that person came up with. And eventually, it became what we know it now as this kind of beast of a valley. And essentially, that is what I think aviation have done and are still doing and are still improving on, and that it potentially is what you're looking at doing, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, it'll certainly see how it pans out this year, but like I said, we've got multiple different work streams going on. Is being quite a young company, a young technology company, is certainly has that feel of a technology startup like you get in Silicon Valley. But you said about Matthew Syed on the Rebel Ideas, but it's something we're really keen on is that diverse work group. It's getting away from that everyone's the same, or you get a common copy of somebody, or we take in stuff in the UK and applying that to the Netherlands. No, we're building businesses globally, and it's building, you know, these are, you know, businesses for life, rather than somebody come in and bring sensible expats out or that sort of thing. So it's yeah, it definitely feels in terms of a company and the culture here that we got that startup feel. And it's for me, it's when I think of building teams, it's making sure we have definitely a diverse skill set and a diverse way of thinking. From, you know, we have Dutch people, Canadian people, French people, Belgians, Germans. Yeah, we got, you know, such a diverse team within our safety team. It's and some of the ideas coming out of it is not necessarily how I'd be thinking, but it's not necessarily, you know, that's not saying that's the wrong way of doing it either. It's just interesting to bring all these ideas together, listen to them, and see what we can apply that and make it work for us. Yeah,
it's interesting, like the word diversity. I think we're a bit short-sighted with it, in a way that if we say diversity, we think, oh yeah, okay, we need to employ more women, we need to employ more, you know, ethnic minorities or different religions, different cultures, different countries, blah blah blah. But it can potentially go so much further than that as well. I think of, like, what about difference of experience? And how many job adverts do we see, you know, looking for a group health and safety manager for a manufacturing plant, must have extensive manufacturing experience. And I'm like, why? What, then you're only going to ever get ideas from manufacturing. Why would you not? And again, this was a conversation I had a while ago, and with a recruiter, you know, it was a phenomenal job, and I thought, oh, that'd be a great job. And I know, I haven't got enough manufacturing experience. Yeah, but I've got experience elsewhere. Yeah, but they want manufacturing. Yeah. But I might have ideas. I'm not saying I do, but I might have ideas that are from healthcare and housing that you'll never know, that you will never, ever come across, because you're only ever employing somebody from manufacturing. And it's the same with cultures and countries as well. And you know, anyone that's thinking of a book to read, go and get Rebel Ideas. For me, I'm at the tail end of it now, probably the last couple of chapters. It blew my mind. It's blowing my mind. But like you say, your team's in Finland and Netherlands, that you're on a Skype call, you're in a meeting, whatever, and they go, what about this? And you're like, I'd have never thought of that.
I think, you know, in terms of industry, what we have in our team, especially our senior safety team, from oil and gas to maritime to engineering to defense to rail infrastructure, none of that is data centers or strictly construction, but to have those kind of different ways of looking at things is brought diversity. Definitely sold. And so he mentions in that book as well about the reason UK politics got it so wrong, that every person in politics is from private education, upper class, and think when they sort of solving certain crises, why don't they just sell bits of their art to fund the heating crisis? It's completely detached from the real world, but it's not detached from the world they're used to. So it's that thing, you know, probably naively a few years ago, and I thought, I'll build a team and I'll build another clone, you know, another three clones of me. I thought that'd be great, but then it's what don't I know? That's the scary part. But if you get a really diverse team on that, that's great. And we have a fantastic safety manager operating our data center in the Netherlands, and it's for me that he's lived there, he's breathed that culture all his life. He's Dutch. He's very Dutch, and he knows Dutch. It's why don't I know that he knows, which is going to be applicable to that site and that project? And he's on who am I to tell him any different? So let's listen, you know, let's be humble about it. Let's listen to people and bring their ideas into play.
And I suppose in a way, do you feel like, was that a bit serendipitous? Like, were you forced into that because you operate in so many different countries? Like, you inevitably had to get somebody from Finland, for example, to understand Finnish legislation, guidance, etc.
I think you know, there's lots of, you know, neat tools and software out there at the moment. So we use software called Anisa, and that's so that's just basically our regulatory forecasting kit and legislation, health, safety, and environment legislation each country. And just for us, just for us, but for anybody who takes it up, it gets provided in English, which makes it a lot more easier to digest for an English speaking company. So it's we got that in there, but for me it's local knowledge, which maybe isn't written in black and white of how people act, or to be able to interact with subcontracting teams or know the particular type of custom or culture or social nuance is different there compared to another part of the country. I'll give an example. I'm a proud Welshman, but if I go anywhere in America, they all call me English, which I said that's like calling them Canadians. It's not. if you think of what, you know, there's certain elements which maybe are unwritten, which I don't necessarily know about. So that's or anybody with a similar sort of background to me knows about, which we diversify that team. It's going to make us a lot stronger.
Yeah, I like that. And there's a power to that, isn't there? And it's a vice versa power. Like, your team in kind of Finland, for example, understand that local culture and stuff, but you'll be able to drop that kind of a penny in the ocean, that kind of odd question here and there that might open their minds to say, oh, that's quite a good English Welsh idea that we would have never thought of, and vice versa. There must be some quite interesting conversations in the room or in the Skype calls that you guys have. That must be quite fascinating. I'd like to be a fly on the wall in there.
It's quite positive, definitely positive.
And I think that applies to even within one country. It doesn't necessarily have to be outside. Like, there's quite obviously a clear north-south divide in England, and then within that each county is different. Within that each town's different, and it's so funny. I mean, I've worked for businesses that are national, and I've worked for one particular business, and I've said, like, you have got a huge north-south divide. Huge north south, like more than the country. It's absolutely massive. And if you look at how that company had grown, it had basically come from companies buying out companies. So people in the South were previously one separate company that were then purchased by the existing company, which naturally creates a little bit of a divide, I think. So you have to kind of work hard to fix that. Then you exacerbate that by the existing North-South divide. Yeah. And then you look at the way the business was operating, and it was like, well, this is how we do it in the North. Why doesn't it work down there? And your people up North will be like, oh, it's always terrible down South. You know, it's bad down there. The Southerners are like, oh, God, that's just them lot up North. Everybody gets all the money up North. And it's like, do you know what? This is so obvious to see. Why are people not picking this up? It just blows my mind. Why can you not sit back and look at this and go, oh, okay, we need to kind of maybe work it like devolve power. Yeah, devolve power, like with councils and stuff like that, and just say, okay, fair enough. This is a standard we as a business want to deliver. We want to deliver this and this and to this standard. Go and do it, please. However you want to do it in Northamptonshire, which is where I'm from, go and do it. Cool.
Exactly how we set our management systems up is give people the flexibility to build and succeed.
I find it interesting that the way we kind of we'll bring this to a loop soon. I'm trying to work out how long we've been waffling on for. I find it interesting that I get my backup about the word compliance. So we got a huge compliance culture in England, as you're probably aware of, especially if you listen to this podcast. And don't worry, I'm not going to get on a compliance rant, but I was thinking about it the other day, and I was writing something basically, and I was like, "Oh, do you know what I'm going to write here? Is I'm going to put the definition from the dictionary of the word compliance." Now, what I'd completely forgot is there's legal compliance, which essentially or compliance of being told what to do, basically. Like, you are a compliant person. You are my dog is compliant when I have a treat in my hand, for example. But then there's the kind of engineering point of compliance where they go, how compliant is that metal, or how compliant is that plastic, which is like how much it moves and bends and how it complies with you. And I was like, isn't that interesting how we look at compliance from a, you must do as you're told and be compliant, but yet we can look at a piece of metal and say that metal is really compliant, it'll flex, which is what we don't want to do in a culture of compliance. We don't want to flex and bend the rules, etc. And I thought that was just a bit interesting. That's just kind of crazy how my brain works, but I thought that was interesting.
I think it's interpretation. It's quite a long bit. So it's, you know, especially when you look at legal writings, you know, especially in the UK, you know, is up until that case law comes into place, it's down to interpretation. I remember with back a few years ago, not too long ago, when we were still waiting for that first sort of case law to come up with the principal designer. We're all within CDM. Up until that point, I remember sitting with a client when I was working for consultancy, and I was like, this is our best interpretation as to what this is, but until testing case law, we don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah.
Waiting for that to hit before we can say, well, this is, you know, we can say based on that, but then generally it's down to interpretation of that law.
Mm. It is, but then I think as well, like, it's quite interesting when people talk about, I find the compliance culture comes from people that maintain buildings. So like the FM world seems to be quite heavy in compliance, because you must do a fixed wire inspection every 5 years, you must do a gas safe check, etc. And they kind of class that as compliance. But then they roll health and safety in with compliance for obvious reasons, I get that. But then I remember challenging a member of a board once and saying, you know, what does compliance mean to you? You've stood up there and said compliance, 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 we'll be going to be 99.9% compliant, blah, 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 blah. What is compliance to you? And he came back with quite a good political answer, which was, you as the safety professional, James, should be able to tell me that answer. And I was like, oh, who am I speaking to here? Boris Johnson or something? I was very impressed with his answer. But in a way, how can you be compliant with the Health and Safety at Work Act, or the Management Health and Safety at Work, which tells you do a risk assessment, or the Health and Safety at Work that tells you do what's reasonable and practicable? What's reasonable and practicable? Well, that's based on an opinion, an interpretation within your business. You as a team of safety professionals, engineers, electricians, builders, whatever you do as a business, but you collect the relevant people for the process that you're risk assessing and determine what is reasonable and practicable to implement. So being compliant is an opinion. It's a perception within your business. My compliance is completely different from yonder's compliance, for example.
Yep. Subjective.
Yeah, exactly.
It's subjective, but do you really want to test that with a man in a curly wig? Probably not. Or woman.
Well, that's a good point. I remember somebody asking me a long time ago, and they said, when do we know the risk assessment's right, James? I said, when you're standing in court in front of a judge, and if you're standing in court in front of a judge, the risk assessment wasn't right. And that's the irony of what we've got to do here. But I do think that the fear of the courts and maybe compensation and stuff like that, kind of civil law more so, that the fear of that culture maybe stifles us a bit. Like, I just think, like, well, why don't you try and create an environment where people don't want to sue you?
Yeah.
Because they love working for you, for example.
I think I'm bringing back that point in terms of that's what we're doing as a company. It's we talk about elegantly, I said again, without bringing the contracts out every 5 minutes to go through that line by line. You said you do this, but you didn't do that. So now I'm not going to pay you this or whatever. It's let's think about this and, you know, let's all deliver to that goal. And tying back into, I said about Dan Coyle, his book, like the Culture Code and the Talent Code, is when people have those three elements of that safe environment, that shared vulnerability, that if we don't get this right, we're not going to make the money we need to make, or have that common goal of when we do get this right, we're all going to succeed. Once when people are aware of those elements of it, and it's very conscious in people's minds, then suddenly we don't have to go down that point of doing that or getting sued or going down the lawyer's route, because as soon as you start talking to lawyers, it gets really expensive.
Yeah, it does. I find it interesting. I don't know if you watch. Have you ever watched the Explained series on Netflix?
No.
Watch it. In my opinion, I think everybody should watch it. It's phenomenal. They're 20-minute episodes about a single subject, and they get really into the nitty gritty, and it's amazing. But there's one point that I kind of want to finish it. If anybody thinks, okay, yeah, maybe I'll watch it, or you've got a spare 20 minutes, watch the Pirates episode. Right. And there's one thing in the Pirates episode that they're talking about why pirates were so popular, you know, like the Pirates of the Caribbean, everybody wanted to be a pirate, blah, blah, blah. And it's around the kind of same era, I suppose, of punishment hierarchy as Sharp. So, you know, if you were in the military then, it was a horrible life. Like, you were not a gentleman, you were like the scum, the pond scum, etc. You get whipped and punished if you weren't good, right? So why was pirates so popular? Because they were compensated, they had a compensation scheme, like an actual scheme that if you lost a leg, that had a figure, the same as our kind of precedence in case law now in civil law, it would say like a lost a leg is roughly $2,000, right? Had exactly the same in pirates. It blew my mind when I watched this. I was like, hang on a minute. Pirates got this. They understood what leadership, what man wanted was to be paid. I'll risk my life, that's fine. But I risk my life thinking, well, if I lose a leg, I'm going to get some money back anyway. So either way, I quite enjoyed it. They had a culture of the people in the ship, the pirates, were asked by the captain, what do you think? What do you think we should do? This is what I think we should do. Obviously, the captain ultimately made a decision, but they were engaged and they were involved in that decision-making process. Fundamental basics of leadership and compensation and remuneration and all that, pirates understood this. Criminals. But yet some of the biggest corporations in the world do not understand this. It's crazy.
Risk and reward.
It blew my mind. Anyway, okay, Gareth, that'll do. Let's leave it there. To be honest, I think we're both a similar mindset, and I think we could end up waffling on all day, and I think it'd be better to do that not in the morning and not over Skype. It would be better to do that in the pub in the afternoon. So let's kind of leave it there. If people wanted to continue this conversation with you about curiosity, etc., or even if they're just interested in yonder, they can reach out to you on LinkedIn. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Gareth Evans, and I'm also on Twitter, and that's LinkedIn, my LinkedIn profile. So please reach out.
We'll put both in the description for everybody as well. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Gav.
Thank you, James. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, guys, I hope you've enjoyed that podcast. Final apology from me. I'm so sorry we were gone for so long. We'll be back as much as we can. I'd like to say we're going to commit again to weekly, but you never know. We will be committing to weekly again. So every Monday, there'll be a podcast again, unless we miss the odd one. But we are back. Back again. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. All the links and stuff that we mentioned in the podcast, they are below. Don't forget to hit subscribe on our YouTube channel, because there's so much more content over there as well. If you're interested about the HSE Congress, you can keep subscribed over there, and you'll be able to see what that looks, feels like, country smells like, but you'll get a feel for it, and it'll be really good. If you haven't already, click follow on this podcast. If you've unclicked follow because we were gone so long, then click it again and try and think of three people that will benefit from this conversation with Gareth Evans and share it with them. You don't have to share it with everyone, just them. And please, I was going to ask for a rate and review, but you know what? I'm not going to because I don't deserve a rate and review. I've been gone for so long, I don't deserve it. And frankly, you know, we've been doing this podcast a year and I've only got three. So you're not listening anyway. Nice to be back, guys. Catch you next week in the podcast. Safe. Hey everyone, you're looking for something a little bit different for your next digital or physical conference, business event, safety event? How about Health and Safety's first and only YouTuber? Go to www.rebrandandsafety to get Rebrand and Safety at your next event, or email me at james@rebrandandsafety.com. Catch you later. Safe.